This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. George Friedman has made it his business to know what's going on in the world. His business is Stratfor, which has been described as the world's leading private intelligence company. He is also a political scientist with a PhD in government from Cornell and the author of 6 books, including the New York Times bestsellers The Next Decade and The Next 100 Years. He's made it especially to analyze world political trends and from them predict what the future may bring in terms of geopolitical conflicts. In 2009, he wrote Flashpoints, The Emerging Crisis in Europe, and other recent writing has also focused on changes there. Much of what he sees is troubling. In town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte and speaking today at the Charlotte City Club, for which, by the way, seats are still available, and you can get information about that on our website at WFAE.org, George Friedman joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you for having me here.
I'm glad you got out of the airport. We were just having a discussion about how Charlotte is so important to world transportation because of our airport, but nobody ever gets into town, and you finally made it out of the airport.
This is the first time in a long time that I did.
Well, congratulations. You were born in Hungary, I'm told, of parents who survived the Holocaust, only to have to flee from Hungary because of communism. You were really, really young at the time. I mean, you were an infant at the time. But still, I'm sure that that has somehow shaped you, and if not your worldview, but certainly your interest in world politics. Is that really the crux of it, the beginnings of it for you, or did that come later in life?
Well, I grew up with parents whose memories were shaped by things like the First World War and their parents, mm-hmm. things like the Holocaust, things like escaping from the Soviets who were seeking to arrest them, making their way to the United States through very complex things. It shaped me in this sense. What I learned from my parents is the world is a much more dangerous place than it appears. That if you'd asked them in the 1930s, was this what their life was going to be like?
Yeah.
It would have been the last thing they thought of.
And yet your parents survived. When we say they survived the Holocaust, they survived in a different way than many of the other Jewish people who survived the Holocaust, because they lived in Hungary. And Hungary, I didn't know this until I read all about this yesterday because of you, Hungary was semi-protected from Hitler. And the Jews were kind of protected by the leader of Hungary, who was not on board necessarily with the solution, the final solution. He was just trying to protect his citizenry from Nazism by being as cooperative as he needed to be, essentially.
Exactly.
So they survived because they lived in Hungary.
Many didn't, but I mean, there are two things to remember about my family. Part of the price that, and the leader's name was Horthy, mm-hmm. that he had to pay was to send troops to the Soviet Union during the invasion. My father got caught up in that, wound up just north of Stalingrad.
Right, and the Jews were on the front line.
And the Jews were absolutely on the front line. They were in labor battalions.
Yeah.
And then he had to walk back to Budapest in about 1,000 miles in the winter of 42-43.
So that certainly shaped their outlook.
But they were both in concentration camps, because although Horthy put it off till 1944, mm-hmm. in 1944 the Germans made it an overwhelming national objective to liquidate the Hungarian Jews. So although it was a shorter period of time,
right.
it was a very intense period of time.
You spent 2 decades teaching political science at Dickinson College, and during that time, or shortly afterward, I'm not sure exactly what the timeline is, you consulted with and or briefed senior commanders in the armed services here, also at the Rand Corporation and at the Army War College, among other places, on national security and defense issues. How did that happen? Why you?
Well, I was a political scientist.
Because that's the point of my question.
But there are a lot of political scientists. To go back to the beginning, I was involved in helping design the first computerized war games for the Pentagon. I had a graduate degree in a PhD in government, but I also had a degree in operations research, which is applied mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1973, these war games that had been played for 200 years got onto computers. When we put them on computers, we discovered something very interesting. We needed a much higher level of specificity for the database than we had. So a question, how many times can a T-54 fire in a minute? A T-54 is a tank, is a Soviet tank.
Okay.
And the answer is 3 or 4. Well, you can't put that in a database. It's 3 or it's 4, it's 3.2, whatever you want. So suddenly, from an intelligence point of view, getting a greater level of specificity on the Soviet capabilities became urgent, or else the game wouldn't work. I was a native Hungarian speaker. I could pass for Hungarian, and the Warsaw Pact had major forces in Hungary. So it gave me an opportunity to be a tourist, so to speak, and go
so
count.
So you were a spy.
No, I don't like to think about myself as that. I simply was an observer.
Okay.
Because being a spy was an extremely dangerous thing to be. I was simply a Hungarian walking through the woods counting.
So you could actually go as they, what, did their military exercises and observe?
For both NATO and the Warsaw Pact, military exercises were not small.
Okay.
They would cover 60, 70 miles. So with NATO exercises.
Okay.
It was impossible not to see them. They were taking their own villages, and we were taking German villages, and the exercises were enormous because the problem of that war was coordinating very large numbers of armor, infantry, airstrikes, and so on and so forth. And you couldn't do that on an army base. You would have to spread out. So sitting in the proper cafe, eventually everything would pass you by in some way or another.
So what did you learn in terms of specificity that you didn't that they didn't know, the military didn't know, but prior to your visiting, so to speak?
I think the most important thing I learned was that the Soviets had no intention of invading Western Europe, which was not a popular thing to say. And the reason I learned that is I noticed the way they were using fuel. The most important thing to have for a tank that's advancing is fuel. They use about a gallon a minute. Getting fuel to them is absolutely the problem of the battle. And the Soviet system of pipelines simply didn't work. They leaked. So I came back the next year, and they were still leaking. The Soviets weren't stupid. They understood that this was a real problem. They didn't think that anybody had noticed. But I drew the conclusion that the Soviets did not intend an aggressive move on Western Europe because key elements that had to be in place, not just that.
Yeah, the infrastructure wasn't there to
support. They weren't ready to do it. Now, this was during a time in the 70s and 80s when it was an idea fix that the Soviets were planning at some point an offensive operation into Western Europe. And kind of the debate was, well, how come they don't do it? Because after Vietnam, we were pretty weak.
Yeah.
And the answer was they really weren't planning it.
So when you came back and told us, I assume that you came back and told our military infrastructure that they were not planning because they couldn't do it. What was the reaction? Did we change our policy?
Well, firstly, the way you report back is interesting. You don't give your conclusion on what it means. Okay. You simply report that this isn't happening. And then I noticed that it wasn't really shifting anybody's thinking about what the Soviet intention was. But I was simultaneously a political scientist, teaching at Dickinson College, lecturing at the Army War College and stuff like that. And I started taking it upon myself to be very frank about what I thought it meant. This did not necessarily make me popular in some areas, maybe very popular in others, but in either case, for me, intelligence was truth-telling.
You were a political scientist at the time, but what you just described doing, going to Hungary, observing, coming back and reporting to the military here what was going on there, is not necessarily what political scientists do.
It isn't, yet they should be. So I would put it this way. One of the problems of intelligence in all countries is that the government tends to have a monopoly over it. Journalists should be doing this, but they frequently don't have the expertise to know what to look for. So since they've
How
never...
How did you?
Well, because I had been designing war games.
Okay.
I realized...
How did you have the... Aside from the mathematics, how did you have the expertise to design the military side of the war games?
I had been a hobbyist. Okay. I've been a hobbyist. They used to have them in boxes. Companies like Avalon Hill produced them. And there were people who, like today, play video games. We played war games.
Okay.
And the Pentagon, particularly a guy called Andy Marshall, who just retired from the Office of Net Assessment, said, you know, these hobbyists may have some idea of how to do this. And what we did was map the box games to the computer. And so there are many strands that take a life that you don't expect to have any impact. But it was not the political science background, per se, that was critical. It was my experience in gaming, which had a lot to do with mathematics. It was the fact that in the process of gaming and designing the war game, I realized what things really mattered and what wasn't. You know, that this fighter plane go supersonic is very nice. How much fuel does it consume? That's right. Really important. And then finally, it came down to the fact that I could speak foreign languages.
Was your point of view on these weapons systems, for instance, not just that it could go fast, but here's how much fuel, here's the practical nature of it. You have to have fuel, and here's how much it takes. Was that a new way of looking at things in these military games? Is that something that the military didn't see because they're too close to the forest to see the trees? Or
the military saw it as the problem. It was the civilians in the Office of the Secretary of Defense who had not been in the military, who had not themselves gone on exercises. They were the ones who tended to look at very different things in measuring the capabilities. So what was happening was that unintentionally, I was taking the old military view that an Eisenhower would have had, mm-hmm. or a Bradley, mm-hmm. and the whiz kids that Robert McNamara had brought in, and all of these guys. I had their skills in the sense that I was not as good a mathematician as any of them, but I understood systems analysis and things like that. But I had understood through the war game what mattered and what didn't. And I was able to come back and say on the ground, hey, something's very odd about the Soviets. Okay. Something they should be really worried about, they're not. And that must mean something.
You mentioned a second ago that the one of the problems with intelligence is that governments have a monopoly on it and that journalists who should be doing the job don't have the training or the expertise to do it. But you started your own private intelligence company in the 90s called Stratfor, Stratfor. Why the name?
Well, the name was actually Strategic Forecasting.
Okay.
However, this minor thing had happened called the Internet, and it wasn't going anywhere. And they said, well, we need a website and email addresses. I said, well, I'm not typing in Strategic Forecasting every time I write an email. Let's call it Stratfor. And that is the truth and the sum total of how it happened.
So your company's website says that you provide strategic analysis and forecasting to individuals and organizations around the world. By placing global events in a geopolitical framework, you help customers anticipate opportunities and better understand international developments. Given that every country on Earth has its own intelligence apparatus, are you hired primarily by corporations, or do governments actually hire you for some work?
We try not to work for governments.
Okay.
For the simple reason that when you work for a government, the government frequently knows what answer they want.
Hmm.
Whereas businesses only want, by and large, only want the truth. They're making money. They don't want to lose money. The CEO really cares. So they don't make you try to fold it. Just, you know, tell me what's going to happen. I'm operating in this country. I have investments of $1 billion. I really don't want to lose them. You know, tell me what's happening.
So they're worried about stability. They're worried about politics. They're worried about hot spots cropping up that might disrupt their supply or their distribution or even their ability to manufacture. Correct?
Well, they worry about economics.
Right.
We do something called geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And geopolitics combines economics, politics, and military.
We're going to come back and talk about that and about some of your predictions as well. George Friedman is our guest, author of Flashpoint, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting The Normal Heart, a desperate writer struggles to eliminate the truth of the AIDS virus before it becomes an epidemic. Now through April 4th, tickets at carolinatix.org. And Henderson Properties, providing real estate sales and property management throughout the entire Charlotte region for over 25 years. HendersonProperties.com. Women make up the majority of the population. In many cases, they are the breadwinners in their families, and yet they continue to lag behind men in terms of opportunities in the workplace and in terms of what they make. Victoria Butson says it is something that is systemic in our culture but not insurmountable. She is the Wage Gap Warrior, director of Harvard's Women in Public Policy program, and she will share her thoughts about all of this tomorrow at 9. And next Thursday, April 2nd, at the Evening Muse, we'll be recording a special musical edition of Charlotte Talks. We'd like you to be there. Info at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, many doctors support Angelina Jolie's decision to have her ovaries removed 2 years after a preventive double mastectomy, testing for BRCA genetic mutations, and debate over surgery to reduce cancer risks.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The World Affairs Council of Charlotte always brings great guests to Charlotte, and today they have brought George Friedman. He is a political scientist, author, and founder of an intelligence company, a private intelligence company called Stratfor. He's also the author of The Next Decade, The Next Century, and Flashpoint, the emerging crisis in Europe, much of which we will talk about this hour. I want to put what we just talked about into some context in terms of years when you were reporting for the military on what was going on in Hungary and came to the conclusion that the Soviet Union had no intention because they had no infrastructure to support the intention to invade Western
Europe. They hadn't
Europe.
Built the infrastructure they would actually need.
That was during the Ford administration.
That was during the Ford administration. That particular.
Because I assumed it was the Reagan administration, but no, it's the Ford administration. That's a long time ago.
The Reagan administration, unlike the Ford administration, had a very good handle on Soviet capabilities. They publicly maximized it. Internally, they saw the weakness. And so they put their focus on breaking the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. whereas in the Ford administration, they were still 10 feet tall.
Okay. And would it be safe to say that some of your reporting and analysis helped them realize that we could turn our attention to breaking them as opposed to being afraid of them because they were 10 feet tall?
I'd like to think that, but in all likelihood, the report got lost in the master.
You're known for making predictions about what the future may hold. That's what you do for the companies that you work for in your private intelligence business, and that's what you do, what you've done over the course of several books. Now, you don't do this, obviously, by looking into a crystal ball. You do this by making educated, calculated assessments of where world conditions are now, where they are likely to go, and where political movements might take us. How often are you right?
We do a report card on ourselves, and the last year, and there's been study of that, was we were right 81% of the time.
Okay.
That's misleading. So if you're right in Burundi's change of government, mm-hmm. but you miss ISIS, I mean, what is 81%? So it's a weighted thing. We're pretty good.
And did you miss ISIS?
We did not miss the radicalization of ISIS. We missed the fall of Mosul.
Okay.
We missed the fact that they were going to be this aggressive.
Would I be right in saying it would be impossible to be 100% right?
I would think so.
Because there are too many moving pieces, right?
On a broader level, it depends what time frame. The longer the time frame, the more likely you are to be right. Mm-hmm. This is a paradox. The shorter the time frame, the more likely you are to be wrong. Because the shorter the time frame, the more it has to do with subjective decisions by leaders and things like that that may not be fully explicable. You take it out to a 10 or 20 year cycle, a lot of those personalities just disappear. They get washed up in the broad statistical structure, and you get to be much more accurate. So I'm very confident in my 100 year predictions.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very right on the 10 year predictions. Next week is tough.
You're like the weatherman. the reason I brought up how often are you right is because I remember talking about this on the radio back in the 90s about everybody was so afraid of Japan because they'd bought up all this real estate in Manhattan and they were going to take over the world. And people were just bemoaning the fact that we were selling stuff to the Japanese, these iconic buildings in New York. In the 90s, you wrote a book about the impending war with Japan, which never, thankfully, materialized. Why did you believe that it would?
Well, firstly, I was predicting that war for the 2020s.
Oh, well.
So it was not. So publishing is an interesting place.
Have you changed your mind?
No, I haven't.
Really?
In fact, I've repeated it. Look,
okay.
Japan is statistically the third largest economy in the world. Mm-hmm. In my mind, it's second largest economy because I don't believe the Chinese statistics.
Okay.
Either way, this is a massively successful country. It is socially united and extraordinarily vulnerable. For every pound of Toyota they ship out, they have to import 7 pounds of raw materials.
Okay.
They have no oil, they have no iron ore, they have no bauxite, they have no natural resources. So they're importing it. And all the waters they're importing it through are controlled by the United States. So they are able to be an industrial power to the extent that the United States lets them be. Now, the United States has no intention of stopping them.
Right.
But the United States gets involved in activities that scare the living daylights out of the Japanese.
Really?
They get their oil from the Persian Gulf. The Straits of Hormuz being opened is a matter of life or death for the Japanese. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is capable of invading Iraq, is capable of invading Iran. It takes risks that are not risks for it, but are huge risks for the Japanese.
Okay.
The Japanese at this point have a very large military establishment. They also have a constitution that says they can't have a large military establishment. That's worth noting, Article 9. They have a substantial navy, a capable air force, an army that's larger than the British Army.
Why?
They look around the world and they see two levels of threats. They live in a dangerous neighborhood with North Korea, mm-hmm. Russia in an unpredictable state, the Chinese, and so on. They worry. They also have a strategic problem. It's like their circulatory system. They were an animal whose circulatory system is on the outside of the body. So their entire life support system goes thousands and thousands of miles away to Indonesia, to Australia, to the Persian Gulf. And if that breaks down for any reason, and this is what led to World War II, because the United States blocked the sale of oil. If that breaks down, they can't be an industrial power.
So when you talk about an impending war, you're not talking about a shooting, banging war. You're talking about what? They're insisting that we not do certain things, even though they might be in our interest because it hurts them?
Well, conflict it comes in a number of ranges. I mean, we had a non-shooting conflict in Europe with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. It wasn't trivial. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Japan, they physically have to get this material.
Right.
And if something were to happen where the United States decided that an overriding interest dictated that they not get this material and they had no other option. So the Japanese are necessarily paranoid. It's not paranoia. It's a very healthy realization of the situation. And they understand that the United States is both the guarantor of their interests and the worst threat to their interests. And they regard the United States as highly unpredictable.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the United States is seen by most of the world as enormously powerful and fairly random in its response.
Do you think we're random?
I think there's a deep structure to what we do that makes a great deal of sense. I think if you're the president of a country wondering if we're going to get involved in Yemen, you really can't figure that out. And whereas the United States has a logic to it that I can roll through, if you're a decision maker in any of these countries, you see the United States as both enormously powerful and impossible to figure where they're going to wind up next.
Are we more powerful than Britain was when the sun never set on the British Empire?
Certainly. The United States produces almost 25% of the world's economy.
Yeah.
And we're the first power in the history of the world to control all the oceans. That seems an archaic consideration, but in the end, if you believe in that globalization is happening and you believe in trade as critical, then the oceans are the highways. Mm-hmm. The ability of the United States to control the oceans means we can impose sanctions on an Iran or a North Korea at will. We have the negative control to shut down trade as and which we want. We don't use it very often. But it's there.
You think the average American understands that kind of power, the power that we have, that either we do or we do not wield?
The average American, in my mind, is manic depressive. And by that I mean we have only been the world's single superpower since 1992. That's a very short period of time. We are not used to this role. We're not used to thinking about us having this role. We're not at all sure we want this role. We'd rather give it up, but we can't. So the American, on the one hand, understands that we are the world's leading power. On the other hand, believes we're on the verge of collapse.
Yeah.
So this strange paradox, not different from the British. Look, the British, at the beginning of their empire, fought a third world power and was defeated. I'm talking about America. And in spite of that, it rose. The United States is in the process of maturing into something it doesn't want to be and that runs counter to its fundamental principles.
An imperial empire.
Yes. We are the first great anti-imperial project, and we are the unintended empire. Mm-hmm. We want to give it back, but not the benefits, of course. We want to not have the responsibilities, but we want the world to be shaped the way
we
want.
But we seem to be scared to death. Here we are, the most powerful force the world has ever known, controlling, as you say, for the first time ever in history, all of the world's oceans. And we seem to be scared of our own shadow. We have the highest military budget of any country in the world, and it's like, what is it? I've forgotten the figure. Our budget is the combination of like 13 countries who couldn't come after us if they wanted to. And we want more money put to the military budget. Why?
Well, we have multiple fears. One is the fear that the Great Depression is about to return.
Almost did,
but didn't. And that's the important part to understand why it didn't. We're convinced that our government is corrupt and stupid. We are convinced that the world is filled with dangerous enemies. There are. ISIS and so on. How dangerous it is, and is it more video than, you know, these are all questions to be asked. But we do not have a mature, stable understanding of how the world works. And there are two reasons. One, we're a very provincial country. We're a provincial country because our geography makes us provincial. In Europe, they say, well, we are very well aware of foreign policy. Yes, the Belgians know what the Dutch 20 miles away are doing. So that's like saying that North Carolina knows what South Carolina is doing.
Right.
We can travel vast distances without learning a different language. We are not a European country. We are a very different country. And we're very uncomfortable with the conflicts that exist because our view is that we have been drawn into these conflicts and we benefited little, and we really have to avoid it. So,
and yet we've been on a constant war footing since World War II.
Well, we spent 17% of the 20th century on war, on major wars.
Mm-hmm.
So far in this century, it's been only 98%.
Only 98%.
So what I'm saying is we are both appalled by a militarist culture and the most warlike nation in the world.
Yeah.
This is what you'd expect from Rome. You'd expect it from Macedonia and Alexander the Great. You'd expect it from the Persians. You'd expect it from the British. We are in this position. And there's a word you cannot mention.
Which is?
Empire. It is a word that you cannot say.
And yet people will tell you, and we've had this discussion, that we have to be very, very wary of China because they have an enormous military. They have an enormous population. It's a big country. They are quickly becoming an economic power. But you say that whoever dominates North America is virtually assured of being the dominant global power. And for the 21st century, it is the United States who will dominate North America. Does that negate the rising influence of China?
China's influence now is declining. Its growth rate used to be 12-13%. They're claiming that they will get 6% next year.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that they have 6% now. It had a massive run, a magnificent run, but pretty much as Japan before it, it's over.
And you point out, interestingly enough, that it is the people on the coasts of the coast of China that benefit from their recent prosperity and growth, whereas you go into the interior of the country, they're desperately poor.
According to Chinese statistics, 640 million Chinese out of 1.4 billion live on household incomes less than $2 a day. Another 400 million live $2 to $4 a day.
So the upshot of this is that they, like Japan, but they are an exporting country. If suddenly the world stopped buying what they made, they couldn't buy what they make.
And that's the problem that happened in 2008. The world stopped buying. Their biggest customer is Europe. And Europe is in deep recession, some parts of it in depression.
Yeah.
they are not able to sustain it, plus the fact that their wage rates have risen so high that it is cheaper by far to have a factory in Mexico than in China, and the Chinese are moving their factories to Mexico. I mean, this is a normal process. You have enormous run, and you get great inefficiencies, and you have to pause and rebuild. The problem that the Chinese have, which is why they now have a massive purge going on and a dictatorship imposed, is only a small fraction of China participated in this miracle,
right,
the coastal region. The vast majority hoped they would and didn't. And they have to both transfer money, if you will, to the interior and keep the interior happy. This is where Mao's revolution came from. And they have to do this without getting a backlash from the coast. They're walking a tightrope. It also has to be remembered that they can't attack anybody on land. The Himalayas, Siberia, there's nowhere to go. They're locked in. And while the Chinese do have a navy, and our own navy will emphasize it at budget time to no end, they don't have fleets. In other words, what they lack above all else are admirals. To fight a fleet battle, you have to have an admiral who's risen in the ranks, learned every part of it, and knows how to fight a fleet battle. The United States has these. Japan has these. The British have these. The Chinese don't. Mm. They have no history of this. And it takes generations to build a command structure to fight a navy.
Are they trying to do that?
Well, they're certainly trying now to begin this, but it's like having a baby. Just because you're in a hurry doesn't mean you can have it in 3 months. So they build ships, but they can't sail a fleet. That is to say, they can't sail a fleet 5,000 miles away, supply it, fight it, come home, and so on.
So to clarify what you're saying is that this is not the Chinese threat really doesn't exist in terms of taking over the world's economy or in terms of becoming the world power that the United States is, and that the 21st century will continue to be an American century.
Well, I'll argue that the 20th century wasn't the American century. In the first half of it, the major powers were the Europeans. In the second half, we were in a knife fight with the Soviets. Mm-hmm. And whatever papers I wrote, I can assure you that between the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Vietnam War, and everything else, they thought we'd lose. You know, there was reasonable people who thought that they would take us. Mm-hmm. We have only been the world's global power since 1992.
Really?
When the Soviet Union collapsed, that was it.
Well, that's right, because there were two superpowers.
These were two superpowers, and there was off at field in Omaha, SAC was sitting, and we were on 24-hour alert and scared to death.
And, of course, at the time, during the Clinton administration, there was this, or maybe the latter years of the Reagan administration, there was this talk of the peace dividend. Now, in the absence of the Soviet Union, we could shrink the military, we could put that money to work domestically, etc. That lasted 25 minutes.
Well, it lasted. What happened was that there was a line from Yugoslavia to Pakistan.
Yeah.
It was held together by the Cold War. The U.S. on the one side, the Russian side, clamping down the Islamic world. As soon as that let go, you had the first earthquake in Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. 100,000 dead. And then the rest of the fault line exploded. And nobody expected it to, but after 10 years, we were back at war.
So when we come back, I want to talk about what dangers we do face today, in your opinion, and the jihadists versus Vladimir Putin, and more, with George Friedman, political scientist and author on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Native Plant Society, raising awareness and enjoyment of native plants which sustain the butterflies, birds, bees, and us. Details at ncwildflower.org/NPR. And the Charlotte Symphony, performing works by Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, and Samuel Barber, including Adagio for Strings and Fanfare for the Common Man. Tomorrow and Saturday in Belk Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. Many doctors support Angelina Jolie's decision to have her ovaries removed 2 years after a preventive double mastectomy. And on the Diane Rehm Show today, they explore testing for BRCA genetic mutations and debate over surgery to reduce cancer risks. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation about what the future may hold in terms of geopolitics, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or charlottetalks@WFAE.org will get you to us, as will searching for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter.
It was Kenneth Feinberg's job after September 11th to figure out how to compensate the families of the victims.
Over half the people who died on 9/11 in the World Trade Center, the airplanes, the Pentagon, had no wills.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Our latest collaboration with the New York Times, it's called My Biggest Financial Lesson. Next time on Marketplace from APN.
That's Marketplace at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. George Friedman is our guest. He's the founder of Stratfor, I think it's the world's largest independently owned private intelligence firm. He does work for corporations around the world, but he's also a political scientist and author of The Next Decade, a book called The Next Century, another one called Flashpoint, The Emerging Crisis in Europe. And he is here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. He speaks today at noon at the Charlotte City Club. Seats are still available. You can go to our website for details. Here's another prediction that you've made. The U.S. jihadist war will be replaced by a new Cold War with Russia, even as China's power diminishes. Now, we've certainly seen saber-rattling by Vladimir Putin, and his incursion into the Ukraine certainly is troubling. But we are witnessing actual bombings and horrific terrorist acts on the part of ISIS and other terrorist organizations in the Middle East. Why do you think a new Cold War with Russia will eclipse all of that?
Because the region that's in chaos is of only marginal interest to the United States beyond the threat of terrorism. This is an area invented by the British and the French under a treaty called the Sykes-Picot Treaty. These countries are artificial, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon. They have now collapsed, and what's replaced them is warlordism. Mm-hmm. And none of the warlords, as in Lebanon in the 70s and 80s, can be defeated.
Did we cause the collapse?
We had a role in it by undermining the Iraqis, but this was the reason they had tyrants like Assad and Hussein. Mm-hmm. Was except for a tyrant, you couldn't hold it together.
Right. Did we know that? Did we understand that? Did the Bush administration understand that?
I think the Bush administration understood that the danger of Iraq was not what they had done, but the arena it might become.
Did they understand that before they did what they did?
Yes. And their idea was to preempt.
So the gamble, they thought they could win the bet.
No, their gamble was that they asked the question, where can terrorism arise? We've dislodged it in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so they said, we are terrified by al-Qaeda because we don't understand what they can do. We don't have good intelligence on them. They may have a nuclear weapon. Where could they operate?
Okay.
Iraq was identified as the place. Iraq was also the most strategic country in the Middle East because it bordered on Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Iran. So if you wanted to be in a place where you could reach out and engage terrorists wherever they are, this was the place to be.
So this is a part of the world that's an artificial construction. Countries that were manufactured by Great Britain and France that really have no identification when you get down below the crust of being Iraqi or being Syrian, or it's tribal.
It's clans. It's subnational groups that their primary loyalty is.
And there are two schools of thought, and there are probably more than two schools of thought, but the two dominant schools of thought that I know about, at least, is the fact that the United States has stirred the pot. We're like a little boy with a baseball bat hitting a hornet's nest. We've stirred it all up. And if we'd get out of the way, it would stop. The other school of thought is that they are now facing, as they collapse, the struggle, a struggle within themselves against two factions of the same religious belief, Shiite and Sunni, and that it's really a civil war, and that they have to decide this for themselves, and we should just take a hands-off policy and let them go after each other until it's like the Civil War in America, so, until they decide what they want to be.
So what I would argue is there's a kind of view of huge cultural imperialism, mm-hmm. which is that everything bad that happens in the world, the United States stirred up somehow. 9/11 happened before we invaded, and it was stirred up by itself. The end of the Cold War freed up forces that had been suppressed since World War II, mm-hmm. and these forces arose. The problem the United States has is can't put it down. In other words, the United States sent 130,000 troops to dominate a country of 25 million. That was absurd. You either send many more troops or you don't try it. We don't have the ability to control on a granular level all these groups. There are nations in the region that have a vested interest in doing that.
Did we know that prior to going in?
Our intelligence was that if we took out Saddam Hussein, we would be welcomed as a liberator, and there would not be an insurgency. And some very important, very smart people said that.
But I had conversations around this table with political scientists and cultural experts in the Middle East who said, we're about to break it, and we're going to have to own it because it's going to fall apart.
Well, and the answer
is, if they knew that, why didn't the White House, why didn't Congress, why didn't the Pentagon?
Well, because as much as they said that, it was not clear what anybody said. Most of history, as you execute it, has a lack of clarity. In the end, a certain number of people turned out to be right, and they're now geniuses. But in fact, the situation was more complex. The complexity was this. We had no intelligence on al-Qaeda. Under the Clinton administration, U.S. counterterrorism intelligence really had declined dramatically. The two countries that really had the book on al-Qaeda were Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Hmm. The Saudis were not prepared to take the risk of sharing that intelligence because the United States had abandoned Lebanon, they'd abandoned Somalia. Their fear of the United States was that the United States was a completely unreliable partner. We were asking them to cooperate with us intelligence, accept the risk that followed, and there was a civil war, and we wouldn't stay. Mm-hmm. All right. So part of the entire problem was that we had established since the end of the Cold War a complete unreliability in our actions. And therefore, the people who had to cooperate with us didn't. We had to somehow both show the Saudis that we were serious and intimidate the Saudis. In moving into Iraq, the divisions that were north of their oil fields were Americans. There was no 911 to call. So what we were trying to do was a number of things, which you normally happen in the war. One, get a strategic position. Two, eliminate a regime which was likely to cooperate in the future with al-Qaeda. And three, reshape the perception of the United States in the region. At the root of this was a debate between General Shinseki, who was the head of the army, and Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld felt that we did not need to have more troops than we had going in. Shinseki called for us to build a much larger army, which we didn't have at the time, before we went in. That was the debate. And each side had very good intelligence showing whatever they wanted to show, the danger of intelligence. And Rumsfeld obviously had Paul Wolfowitz and he had other people on his side. Shinseki had most of the military on his side, and it was not a military miscalculation. The military was very uneasy about the intervention. It was civilians and the Office of Secretary of Defense who discounted it.
The same civilians that you explained earlier in this program don't always have all the facts or don't understand the facts because they've never served in the military.
It's more than that. In Washington, you don't do foreign policy. You discuss Washington doing foreign policy. Wow. They maneuvered against each other.
So getting back to your prediction that a new Cold War with Russia will eclipse this jihadist thing, you're saying essentially that this is a tinderbox, the Middle East, that will burn itself out or that the problems with Russia will be so big that we will not be able to pay attention to that?
There are four regional powers, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, all of whom have a much larger stake in what happens. The United States doesn't have the force necessary to deal with it. And therefore, it's going to have to be left to the regional powers. As we saw last night in Yemen, the regional powers took their hand. The United States has a 100-year foreign policy. For 100 years, the United States has had one fixed principle that no European power should dominate the entire European peninsula. Because a united European peninsula has the technology, the capital, the manpower resources to challenge the United States all over the world. And so we engage in the First World War, intervening at the last moment. We engage in the Second World War. This was the entire issue of the Cold War. For 100 years, there's been a highly consistent top-level American policy on this. What I predicted was that given the weakness, extreme weakness of Europe, and Russia's internal imperatives, they would arise again. That the point that they would engage on was the Ukraine, which wasn't very taking a lot of brains. This is the thing that really matters to the Russians. That as the Russians engaged in the Ukraine, the Americans would have the question, how far will they go? Mm-hmm. And we would start creating a line from the Baltics to Bulgaria, which we're doing right now. And we would go into what I call the Little Cold War. That is, I don't think it'll wind up as a nuclear confrontation.
But I was going to ask you, is the Soviet, that's not the Soviet Union anymore, is Russia a paper tiger?
Well, in the region, it's not. I mean, in the region, it can. But it has incredibly, underlying is a profound weakness. And the profound weakness is it depends for its economic well-being on the export of one commodity, oil. And if the price of oil falls, arises, and it can't control that,
right.
It suddenly winds up in economic problems it didn't estimate. In Ukraine, it did very badly. It had dominated the Ukraine. After the events in Kiev, which its intelligence service failed to predict, it had Crimea, which it had by treaty in most ways anyway, and a small strip in the east. So Putin suffered a massive reversal that he has to do something about because he can't just accept that. At the same time, he wound up in a massive economic problem. So is it a paper tiger? I think that overstates it. Is it ultimately weak? Yes.
So a mini Cold War, a small Cold War.
It will not be our bombers flying 24 hours, mm-hmm. our missiles on ready alert, their missiles on ready alert. What it will be, however, is a duel in the borderland between the peninsula and the...
Does that Cold War only last as long as Vladimir Putin is in power, or does it continue if he ever leaves power?
I don't think we should take... Vladimir Putin isn't the issue.
Okay.
When Russia is united, what unites Russia is the Secret Service. This is going back to the Tsar in the Ukraine. It was inevitable after Yeltsin, who was an absolute catastrophe from the Russians' point of view, that the only institution that worked...
The KGB.
The KGB, the FSB now.
Okay.
Would assert itself. It happened that the personality that was on top of this was Vladimir Putin. But underneath Vladimir Putin is a very complex and sophisticated regime tying the oligarchs, the intelligence services, and other things together. And it very much resembles back from Peter the Great,
wow.
The way Russia worked. Now, Russia has always been a country that is economically in disarray, and yet militarily able to defeat Napoleon and Hitler. So it's a bit of a paradoxical country. And the thing to be very careful of is taking it too seriously or not taking it seriously enough. It has a place. It has a threat. I think the United States is making prudent steps in controlling it. It doesn't go into it. But what happens in Europe happens in the most prosperous place in the world.
And we have 3 minutes left. So I want to talk about Europe because Flashpoints, the emerging crisis in Europe, is what that whole book is about. You talk about the artificial construction, once again, of the European Union, which was designed to minimize built-in geopolitical tensions, which have lasted for centuries in Europe and have historically torn that area of the world apart. You say simply that design is failing. Talk about that.
The most important country in Europe is Germany again. Germany exports 50% of its GDP. For the fourth largest country in the world, to export that much is extraordinary. It's also unsustainable.
And you've described Germany in the past as being large, powerful, and insecure. And
exactly.
You see them becoming large, powerful, and insecure again.
Extremely insecure because half of their GDP is derived from exports, and one half of that exports to the free trade zone in Europe. The free trade zone of southern Europe is in depression.
Mm-hmm.
26% unemployment in Greece, 22% in southern Italy, 24% in Spain. These are the same numbers we had in the Great Depression.
And you also point out that the United States fought a civil war which decided that no matter what you think, You can't secede. You're in this for the long run. Texas, you're here to stay. South Carolina, you're here to stay. In Europe, that is not the case. And you have these wealthier countries who have weathered the storm, so to speak, like Germany, who don't want to be and don't intend to be brought down by weaker countries like Greece. They're not all in it together.
When we had the 2008 crisis, Texas may not have wanted to give money to New York, but nobody asked them. It was going to happen. In Europe, there is no sense of shared nationhood, nor can you create it. Europe was created for peace and prosperity, not for the moral principles of the American regime.
And each country has its own moral principles.
And also their antagonism to others. Yeah. So we know that in the United States, when the question came, the future of the Union, there were people prepared to die on both sides for this issue. Right. There's no one in Europe who will die for the EU. It's a preposterous thought. You can't hold them together. And therefore, this is just a convenience, a marriage of convenience. It is not a nation, and they'll divorce.
So I only have 30 seconds left, and we didn't have a chance to talk about rising power in Mexico, which I think is fascinating. But what should we be worried about? What should we be hopeful about?
Well, our hope is that this country, compared to China, compared to Europe, is doing extraordinarily well.
Okay.
And we don't want to face that, but we are. We should be very worried about what happens if Europe disintegrates. Europe disintegrating has a history going back centuries of conflict, and it's just not clear to me, I'll put it differently, I have no confidence that Europe isn't going to go back to the way it was once it disintegrates, and I see nothing to stop it.
Well, we'll end it on that note then.
Okay.
George Friedman, Flashpoint, The Emerging Crisis in Europe, Also the Next Decade, and the Next Century. Thanks for the hour.